Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will visit with Dr. Chad Lee, Extension Professor for Grain Crops at the University of Kentucky. Our weekly topic will be lessons learned from the 2022 growing season to help us prepare for the 2023 crop. And as always, we will wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
David, how are you?
I'm doing good. Doing real well.
Good.
We've had a long, long few days here, and we're wrapping things up this evening, so it's been a good time.
That's right. We're currently in Lexington. We're recording this podcast in, I guess, Mecca or Medina, one of the two, whichever way you want to look at it. center of the state is some folks
Golden Triangle,
the Golden Triangle. One corner of it. Anyway.
That's right.
Now we've had a good week up here in Lexington. We've been part of some pretty good trainings and had a chance to sit down with some folks this week that we don't normally get the chance to visit with all that often. That's been really good, and a lot of varied topics that we've talked about, and we've learned lots of good things.
Absolutely. One of been some of the great best information I think we've had in quite some time to be here and honest with you.
And you know, I think you and I both will agree, because we both experienced it. We learned stuff during one recording that we put out to people that day or the next day.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
That's a pretty good turnaround. This recordings are for the public to listen to and learn from, but we certainly learn and gain a lot from them too.
Absolutely. For sure.
Yep. We're with Dr. Chad Lee, and this is the second time we've had a chance to sit down with him. Vicki wasn't with us the last time, David.
Right. He's a retread.
That's two retreads we've had.
That's right.
That's two retreads. That means either the first time was really good or you just forgot one or the other.
Well, I think we have learned so much since the first time, Chad, that it's a lot better. I think we feel like it's a lot better anyway.
Your part was good. It was ours
that needed some improvement. Absolutely.
Our technical capabilities have improved greatly. Yeah. We've learned how to turn microphones on.
Yeah,
that's a good thing.
There you go. So. Not everybody knows that skill.
unlike the last time we got together, we're not going to be encumbered by sirens and ambulances and police and fire department going up and down the road. And shouldn't have to pause for any loud
that's
intrusions.
Right. That's right.
So. We're at the end of the 2022 crop season. We've seen basically what's going to come out of it. Not the year that a lot of people hope for, I think, to say the least. But first impressions on the 2022 season.
Well, I think when you look back, yes, nobody was really happy with the outcome overall when you look at where they got started. But I do think when you look at some of the lack of rainfall that we had and irregular timing of rainfall, I think some people were pleasantly surprised with some of their yields and how well the crops did in some regions. Certainly off of, you know, long-term trends, off of the last 5 years. But in the last 5 years, we've had three record yield crops. And the other two were, I think, top 10 in terms of yield. So we've had a really good run of yields for quite a while. This year was a harsh reminder that when you don't get rainfall, especially in July and August, and in some cases, even just a week or two shifted one way or the other relative to crop stage, it can really wreck the yields you were hoping to get.
And this year, it just seemed like we had challenge after challenge, kind of like you had, I think, started out saying there. Because, you know, we started out planning for 2022, and there was a lot of uncertainty about what inputs would be available. And then how much would they be if they were available? So you had that dealing with on the planning side of it. And then it looked like we were going to have an early spring, or at least down in our part of the world, we thought it's going to be an early spring. Things were going good. Then it started raining, and then it rained for 4 or 5 weeks. And so all of a sudden we went from going to have an early spring to now we're late. You know, and then we finally got that, got it in the ground, and then the lack of rain came along, and then it's like the year that kept giving, you know. And then in July was really wet for us, and then we're back to dry again, and now, you know, it's just like you take one step forward and three back. I think a lot of producers are feeling that.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. You hit on the nail on the head with the uncertainty. So many farmers have gotten used to even buying inputs, you know, in November, October, December, the year before the growing season. And you go back to 2021, there were some inputs they couldn't even get. They couldn't mm-hmm. book, let alone Right, they couldn't price them either, so let alone get a delivery date on anything. And so you throw some pretty big wrenches of uncertainty at the very beginning of it. You get in the middle of the season, and it just depends on where you were in the state, where your crop was at the time. You know, we discussed it earlier that you saw yields in the field that went from zero, I think you said, to 340 bushels, right?
Correct, mm-hmm. yep.
Yeah, so in the same pass in the field, zero to 340. Another farmer, another county agent in over in Adair County said he, you know, was on a combine and went from zero to 300. Not quite as good of an up-end yield, but still. And I had a farmer in Christian County send me a video going from zero to 240. Last year, that field's rotated. Last year, that same type of field went, and I say last year, in 2021, that field averaged 240. 2022, that field averaged about 110.
Yeah, right.
And so
yep.
you're looking at some really big drop-offs in certain parts of the state. You get over into central Kentucky, LaRue County, a farmer was telling me that, you know, all the corn they sort of planted on time did terrible. Anything mm-hmm. that they got planted about a month late by their typical standards did great. And it's just a matter of capturing rainfall exactly when it was needed. Corn is so much more particular about that than soybean. You've got one ear that you're trying to produce on a plant, and as everything builds to producing that one ear and it builds to pollination, that 14-day period before and after pollination is so critical to the overall success of that crop that if you hit it wrong, and a lot of fields hit it wrong this year, there's just no way to fully recover back from that. We saw that all across the state.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say there's multiple variables that are so critical during that 14-day period either side. Water, of course, we see is the limiting factor this year. But a lot of this corn was planted so late that it was pollinating at a time when we had higher temperatures. Had a lot of that corn been planted on time, may have pollinated better. It still wouldn't have the water. But that was a second variable that it had to endure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and when you get the higher heat, that confounds the issue of lack of water because it dries the plant out a little bit quicker. It dries the pollen out quicker. Pollen's pretty sensitive to arid-type conditions. We saw that in 2012. Mm-hmm. 2012, it got to 90 degrees by 9 a.m. a lot of mornings, and it really did it did damage to pollination that year. That one was more specific. You know, we were dry up until about the middle of July, and then we started getting rainfall events to the mm-hmm. point where a lot of soybeans that year did better than corn.
Yep,
I
remember
that season,
yep.
right?
Yep.
So this season, you know, you know, Vic, you mentioned what it was in your region. Those rainfall patterns were different all across the state. I think in Lexington here, the entire month of September, we saw no rain, none. And we had one or two good rainfall events in August that sort of carried stuff through. But we were short in July. We had some decent rain for about 7 days, I believe, in July, but we missed it on either side of that. In fact, we had some soybeans in one study where we had the exact same variety, same treatments, had a May 2nd planting date and a June 1st planting date, so June is late. The May planting date went, I think, 43 bushels, which is not good. Mm-hmm. The June went 65. Yep. On average. And so we just captured some different rainfall events. And when we harvested the beans, they were already like at 9%, which I saw that all across the state this year. Saw a lot of really, really dry beans.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Dry soybeans, not pintos and things like that. But, but folks would love those. A lot of small beans, a lot of BBs that we dealt with this year too. And that's a scenario where we got to the end of the season, things were unseasonably warm, we were dry again, so things dried down well in the field, but they dried down super fast. And I don't know what it was exactly in your region, but here we had good color, and all of a sudden it was gone. That's what it felt like anyhow.
Yeah, yeah.
It was sort of like that for us too, maybe not quite that drastic, but it was, and I know, I forget, I'm in a... They look at, Webster County did pick up a few rains that the other people didn't. I was trying not to bring that up in this podcast.
You missed a few.
Well, I tried not to bring that up, fellas.
Yeah, I know you didn't.
But I was trying not
to. I wasn't
going to
let you forget it.
That's
but
right.
Yeah, she got, Vicky got rains, and all summer long, you know, we were coming up there and recording podcasts and things, and I mean, from at Nebo and coming through Providence and all that, I mean, the crops looked fantastic. The corn looked was green as it could be and looked so good. The beans were, they were great, you know, and down in where Jay and I live, not necessarily work, but we live in Christian County. I mean, it is dry as a bone. We hadn't gotten a lick of rain for nothing, but she, every time it rained or a dark cloud would come over, they'd get an inch, you know, and we didn't get anything, you know. So she was kind of living in the Eden, as Jay called it, you know, from that standpoint. But she her yields were some a good bit better than a lot of ours.
We did get
in that area.
We did get the pictures where she'd run out with her cell phone, take a picture of the rain, and text it to us.
Every
time.
I wanted them to be aware of what was going on.
That's right.
I didn't want it to catch them by surprise.
Point made.
Well, I think that so you look at her region versus the other regions, not that far from it, and you look at previous years versus this. You know, it does affect the psychology of a farmer a great deal, because in a year like this, when you get out into these regions where we had untimely dry periods and it hurt the crop, it makes a farmer and it makes a crop consultant, makes a county agent, makes a crop specialist feel like you've done a bad job because the crops didn't perform well in those areas. And it, you know, you could put all the management you want to on that crop. If it doesn't have water and it doesn't have proper temperature during pollination, it's not going to do well. It just isn't. The flip side, you can make a lot of mistakes in a year when you get very timely rains, and a lot of things will look really good. You know, I joke that the last 6 or 7 years was a really good time to introduce new products into the market, because almost anything a farmer tried,
they all worked.
They all worked, right. Yeah. So, you know, so it was a phenomenal time. Now, this year, I feel sorry for anybody that tried to release something new in 2022.
Yep.
Because not much worked well. You know, imagine, and I imagine there were a lot of probably uncomfortable combine rides between the seed salesperson and the farmer. They probably didn't spend as much time in that buddy seat this year as they have in the past.
Chemical reps, too.
Again, and in that scenario, those new products, if you put them in 2021 season, they may have performed great. But you're coming into this season and not so much. And yeah, even in our variety trials, you see at some locations the late hybrids did well, other locations the earlies did well, and some locations none of them did well.
And it all depended on the rain. You know, and I've told folks for a long time, I think the most limiting factor of any crop is rainfall and water. And timeliness of that water and rainfall is a big limiting factor.
Especially with corn.
Yeah, especially with corn.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I need to go back and pull in 2022's data. I forgot to do that. But if you look at the previous years for about 30, 35 years of data, just looking at, done some adjustments to sort of normalize the data because yields should be increasing over time. And so you sort of take that out. But you're looking at the temperature and the rainfall in July and August, and you compare that to the corn yield in the state. It's about a 70% correlation between those. So it's a massive influence on the final, and that's averaging all the weather across the state, all the yields across the state, throw it all together. It explains yield better than any other in-season management thing we do.
Yep.
Not to say that those other things aren't important. You know, we need timely planting when we can get it. We need good uniform planting, uniform depth. We need to control pests. We need proper fertilization. All those things need to take place to try to capture what the environment will provide us. But a year like last year is just a frustrating year. It's a year where nothing new worked.
Yeah, and you could have done everything like you were supposed to, you know, and you still had, you could have had a crop loss. I mean, you know, could have had a yield loss for sure. You know, even if you had, even if you got to plant it on time, which some folks did and some folks didn't, and you know, seed depth and, you know, all the variables that you can actually control from that standpoint, and you could have still had a crop loss, so you kind of had a loss for what to do at times.
In 2012, there was some discussion, you know, with the drought about that was a year that planting population, like a lower planting population would have helped.
Yes.
You know, just talk about that for just a little bit, because we were, you know, this year we had, I know we all talked about a lot, this is kind of setting up a whole lot like 2012. And you know, our minds going back and thinking about things back from 2012, and that was something that I'd thought of. So talk about that for just a little bit.
Sure, we'll talk about that, and then we'll get into some just overall strategies when you're trying to plan for next year's crop. And I know we're spending a little more time talking on corn right now, but in 2012, corn was what got hurt. Soybeans did great.
Yep.
And so in 2012, it was, you know, the joke was, is the one person in the county that's always late getting corn planted and has a ratty old planter that doesn't put out much corn and had a low population or a poor stand, that was the best field in the county in 2012. Right?
Yeah.
And the joke is you go to the coffee shop or wherever, and that farmer's still talking about how good that crop was relative to everybody else's. And there's several components in there. We know that we can push populations to push yields if we've got water. We know that if we don't have water, then populations become competitive and the plants compete with each other and we reduce yield. And in fact, in our suggestions on planting seeding rates, it has as much to do with the risk of running dry as it does anything else. And so how deep is the soil? How much water can your soils hold during seed fill and such? And, you know, the deeper type soils that'll hold more water, we can put more plants per acre out and be confident they're going to come out okay. Again, we go from about 2014 up until 2021, it benefited farmers to keep inching up on population. There was a benefit to it. Our data would suggest when we have irrigation or when we have timely rainfall, we probably need to be somewhere around 42 to 46,000.
Wow.
Those are phenomenally high populations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, no seed company is recommending that high of a population, and right. We don't either, because even in fields that have irrigation, we're hesitant to really suggest to go that high on populations, but in our small plots and those type of research studies, somewhere around 42 to 45,000, we sort of topped out on where we should see populations giving us the best yield when we know we've got adequate water. But we back off away from that, and so we may be maybe at 38,000 on a good deep soil, and then we back off from there. You get into some shallow slopes, maybe no need to go above 22. And years like 2012, and then the middle years that we've talked about, and then a year like this, all bear that back out. And so what I think, I came here in 2002, and just my memory says from 2002 to about 2013 or so, farmers were a little more defensive in their approach. They were expecting to have some water limitations in July or August that were going to throw off corn yield. And as a result, they weren't necessarily managing for the very best yield possible. They were trying to manage against a little bit of the risk of putting too many inputs out and then having dry weather that cuts mm-hmm. back on profitability.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely.
If you look back, hindsight would tell you from 2013 to 2021, being aggressive and pushing extra probably netted you more yield and probably was a profitable way to go.
Yep.
up to an extent. This is a cautionary year to remind us, we can have dry weather in July and
August. It does happen, yeah.
It does happen. And on our soils that are half as deep as they are in northern Iowa mm-hmm. and northern Illinois, we need to be paying attention to that, because that is an issue we deal with year in and year out. Now you throw in where input costs are expected to be at, just some of the uncertainties around the globe and such, it may make some sense going into 2023 to be a little bit more defensive in your strategy than what we have been the last 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not telling the farmer, I don't know that I would suggest that a farmer back down and say, well, look for that trend yield and try to manage to the trend yield. Maybe look for 5% above that trend yield and manage to that. Don't look for 15% above.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. absolutely.
It does. You know, one of the you mentioned a minute ago talking about strategies, other strategies to think about. One of the things that I think we all can agree we're still going to be facing to a certain extent is input shortages. Even if they exist, even if they're out there, they're going to be maybe have some type of disruption. It's going to make them harder to come by, whether it's price, whether it's availability. Talk a little bit about how we can work that into our strategy. We talk about all year long, we've talked about having a plan A and having a plan B, and talk about how producers can look at that and work that into their fold.
Sure. So I'll be more specific and talk a little bit about nitrogen, because we dealt with that issue in the previous growing season. So we'll chase that rabbit for just a little bit here. You know, one thing you do is you look for, well, what are my other potential sources of nitrogen that I can get a hold of? And, you know, it was chicken litter, but I think most everybody's figured out, hey, chicken litter is a pretty good source. And those that have it are using it. And that's good. They should be.
Yep.
But I think there was some advantages. You know, 10 years ago, there were some farms that jumped in on that early, and I think they're reaping some benefits from that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, manure is a good source option. You get into cover crops, it's a little bit tougher. So some of the legumes, there's been some research over the years looking at legumes and how much they might provide. And some of that gets pretty challenging because you typically have to go with a very late planting date of corn to get much of your nitrogen benefit from the cover crop. In other words, that cover crop's just got to get big and massive, mm-hmm. and in order to produce enough nitrogen to make a difference.
Yep.
Now, 2022 would say planting late didn't hurt. So maybe take a field or two and do that with it. But I think so you go from those two to the next strategy would be that when Dan Quinn was here working with me as a grad student, he did a meta-analysis of some in-furrow research, two-by-two research across the country, and then we did some research on it as well that showed that there's a pretty consistent yield. It's small, but there is a yield increase when you do either in-furrow, you know, you're talking 2-3 pounds of N, a small amount, or you do a two-by-two that might be 20 or 30 pounds of N. Mm-hmm. In that scenario, you're doing one of those two gives you some yield increases. I'd probably lean toward the two-by-two because I could put down 30 pounds of N early and then come in and side dress later. So that's what I'm getting to, is side dressing. I'm talking about another application across the field, but that we demonstrated that in Dan's research on well-drained fields, that side dressing paid for itself. It paid. It was a great way to cut back a little bit on N. Now, our N rates, again, the years he was here, we had good years. So we had really good responses. And I think, you know, we're still looking at, you know, nitrogen rates around 210, 220 pounds on non-irrigated fields that yielded very well. Mm-hmm. But if we put it all up front, we needed a lot higher N rate to get there. Does that make sense where I'm going mm-hmm. with that?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I think those are a couple strategies you could work with. Now, aside from that, the other one would be, you know, if you can secure it, can you store more of it on site? And that gets into other issues that sort of get out of my area. You know, storing liquids requires a certain type of a dike system you're going to have to put in to contain that. Storing dries has its own risks and things to deal with. And really, you kind of need a special shed if you're going to hold that stuff for very long. So there are some issues that way. But I do think we've got some growers that are, if they have enough leftover cash or a good enough banker, they're going to try to hold on to some of that stuff as soon as they can and get it in when they know they can get it in.
Let's talk a little bit about the side dressing thing. We actually talked with Dr. Josh McGrath about this last year, you know, and talked about, you know, when we're talking about side dressing corn is not when the corn is spiking.
No, that's a good question. Right.
So, you know what I'm saying? Right. I mean, you know, you just as well as to put it down all in front if you're going to start doing that, which, and I understand why people do that because they've just got so much they've got to get over, and I completely understand that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times when they're finished side dressing, the corn is still only 2 or 3 inches tall.
Yeah.
So, you know, can we, you know, would it pay them to wait just a little bit, you know, V4, 5 or something, you know, 6 or in that neighborhood to or get started just a bit later and then kind of finish when the corn is about to get to the size you don't need to be running over it.
I think that's it. And it's, you know, this is, let me say at this point, I do think our growers are logistical geniuses. I marvel at what they're able to get done and how much they're able to move, how many acres they can cover through a spring, through a harvest, all of that. And what you just hit on right there is it goes back to those logistics and the fear that, well, if I don't start now, I'm going to get rained out and then I'm going to miss it entirely. I think that's part of where we're at. But if they could, or I'll suggest it this way, if they're going to start that early, they need more nitrogen. And they're going to have to use more. If they can push it and wait till they get to about that V3, V4 stage, they can probably cut back 25, 30 pounds. Maybe a little bit more in some mm-hmm. situations. We know in some heavier type soils, like Vicky's mm-hmm. got a lot of in her county, we know we can cut back closer to 50 pounds in a lot of those areas. So, and I think Josh's studies pretty much show that a 2x2 of about 40 pounds, somewhere in that ballpark, was a really good number to start out mm-hmm. with.
Yep.
One way to look at that is the corn crop, when it gets to that V6, V7 stage, it's only used 25 to 30 pounds at that point. So it's, if you're putting on 40 pounds as a 2x2 and you're coming back and hitting the side dress at V3, V4, or V5, you've got plenty of N out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, in an ideal world, let's just chase an ideal world for a moment, right? Let's chase a dream. Think about the uptake curve on nitrogen. It doesn't really start to become rapid until about V6. V7, V8, somewhere in there, it really starts to get into rapid uptake, and it stays rapid all the way up until pollination. And so in a perfect world, you'd put a little bit up front, that 40 pounds or so, mm-hmm. you come back about V4, V5, give another shot then, maybe come back in about V10, give another shot then, and then finish it out you wouldn't want to do it right at tassel, you don't want to mess with pollination, but maybe just before tassel, throw on your final 30 pounds or so, and let the crop kind of finish out that way. In a perfect world, you'd spoon feed it like that, right?
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And I suppose anybody that has a center pivot, they can right. do that, and that would be a massive advantage to a center pivot.
Do producers ever? I mean, and I know that the research that you all do, as far as in that AGR1, looking at the recommendations in there for nitrogen or any of it, for, you know, for that matter. But you know, a big part of that too is the yield potential of the field that we're talking about. And when we start talking about strategies for shortages or increased input cost, I mean, I think sometimes we forget to talk about, well, what, let's talk about the yield potential of this field. And what do you think about that? I mean, I guess I just want to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so that's we're going to get into a little bit of a discussion. So AGR1 itself doesn't factor in yield potential on corn. It's what they're saying is a good nitrogen rate is a good nitrogen rate. And the challenge is hitting the right rate each year, because that rate is different year right. in and year out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some, let me chase that rabbit just for a little bit. There is some merit to that concept. We did some studies with irrigated corn and 15-inch rows up to 60,000 plants per acre. We did this three application timings minimum, some up front, some at a side dress, and some through the pivots, right around or right after pollination. And in those studies, let me chase this for a moment, we found that irregardless of what our yield was at the end, somewhere around 225 pounds of N is what we needed. Worked out really nice. When you're putting the nitrogen on that way and you've got mm-hmm. irrigation mm-hmm. and such, 225 was a very consistent number. We back up and just say, we don't normally have that kind of consistency. So it was really neat yeah. to see that come out of that study, that any location we were at, that 225 was a pretty consistent number. The other component here was, it didn't matter if we were at 30,000 plants per acre or 60,000 plants per acre, 225 was our best number. And so that would tell you, as there's a point where you got to have adequate N out there, and then there's some yield potential mm-hmm. that gets affected from that. Now the flip side, I think this is some things that Josh would make an argument for, is once your yields get up in that 250, 260, 270 range, you got to start paying closer attention to that yield potential aspect of it as well. And I would say that's one area. Right now, AGR1 caps out at 200 pounds of N per acre for irrigated corn. I think that's too low. John Grove just says we need more years of data on it before we can make that change. But so far, the data's been pretty consistent that when we're in that 225, 230 range, and we've been pretty efficient about how we've had applications, we've had yields right at 300 pounds or 300 bushels to the acre on a nitrogen rate of 225. That's right. Phenomenally mm-hmm. efficient, phenomenally efficient. And I think that's achievable on a regular basis in our irrigated fields. Does that make sense?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It does.
Yep.
So, and I think part of what's in AGR1 too, it goes back to what we were talking about. They're used to years of our soils are shallower soils in Kentucky, and they're used to us being dry for a little bit, and that sort of trumps some of what we mm-hmm. have dealt with right. in the past as well. But any one year, you're looking at your accurate nitrogen rate on a rain-fed situation is going to be somewhere around a 40 to 50-pound range of where you're supposed to be, right?
Right.
And we'll chase another rabbit. There's some products on the market that tell you if you put this product on, you can cut your N rate by 40 or 50 pounds. Well, go figure. So there may be, you know, there may be some connections there that you may be able to cut that rate anyhow.
Yep.
If you hit the right year.
Right. And you also kind of need to be flexible on your application, even from, you know, maybe you're putting anhydrous down before, you know, before planting, and then maybe side dressing if you're, if the corn gets too big, you still have that flexibility with a sprayer or something to use some dribble some nitrogen on that way, you know. And then if you have a center pivot, you know, you can obviously put it through the pivot. But right. I think, you know, having that strategy of being able to be flexible on the way you put your nitrogen on, I think is pretty important, really.
It is, and that's, I mean, not every farmer is equipped to do all those different things, but you know, the wide drop technology and the other ones that mimic that certainly make it very feasible to put some nitrogen on that way. Mm-hmm. And I think even in these last 10 years before 2022, when we've had a lot of rain, we've had adequate rain throughout, it'd be a very rare occasion where a farmer would have been rained out entirely from a field that the farmer couldn't get some N put on before V6, V7 yep. in a cornfield. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Yeah,
not everywhere. And in your area, in those, you know, wetter nature soils, it's a little bit higher risk. So in, you know, Vickies County, you got some more of those. But still, there are options out there for a grower, and certainly that kind of flexibility would be helpful. So we've spent a lot of time just chasing the nitrogen issue. You know, I think the other thing we may deal with a little bit, we won't know that until the spring, really, is we had such a dry year last year. We had lower yields than we expected, so we didn't pull as much P and K off the fields as we normally would. You know,
that's where I was fixing to go.
Oh, well, how about that? All right. And so, you know, and the dry soils, if you pulled a sample in the fall and you got that sample, if you're able to get your probe in the ground in the fall to pull the sample, those numbers could be off a little bit from previous years because the dryness will affect the soil test result a little bit. So you may, I like having more data and then choosing not to use some of it, but yep. that's also yep. a cost, it's mm-hmm. an expense. So I think it makes good sense to look at 2021, 2022 soil test data and then take a look at crop removal rates just to get a ballpark idea of how soil tests may have changed on you. But, you know, if you're looking for silver linings, if the yields weren't where you wanted them to be, you didn't lose as much P and K and zinc and right. some of those things.
And that was exactly what I was going to ask. You know, we started into the 2022 season looking at P and K availability and costs, and we were advising producers to evaluate those levels in their soils through a soil test and possibly use 2022 as a year to mine some of that back out of the ground.
Yeah.
Looking at what we came out of with very little rainfall, very little yields, I was going to ask that question. Do we need to maybe evaluate and look at possibly doing that again?
Need to look at it. I would say there are a lot of things that a farmer can buy that are advertised to reduce risk, to improve plant health, to somehow improve growth or things like that. An extra 30 pounds of P and K per acre will solve a lot of those issues.
Absolutely.
Right. And so
probably a good bit cheaper. than
could,
some of those
could
products.
Be too. If I were looking for what can I do to help, because when you pull a soil test is it's based on the samples you took, and you recognize that in that area. I mean, AGR1 is designed to be about 20 acres at a time. If you're doing grid sampling and things like that, you know, looking at grids, that there's a lot of variability in the field. And so if you're trying to cover up some variability, one of the best ways to do it is a little bit extra P and K. And I'm not talking about, you know, massively excessive rates. If you put on an extra 10, 30, 30 pounds to the acre of P and K, if the crop doesn't use it in a particular year, they're going to be able to use it the next. Mm-hmm. But to your point, when you're looking at the economics and how do I pay for everything and where's everything at, yes, you would expect a little bit less removal, and you need to factor that into your plan going into 2023.
And we do have that crop removal information available for producers to look at.
We do. And we have ballpark numbers in AGR1, actually, that they can calculate out, give them a pretty good idea of where they're at. And then that gives them some ballpark of what they may have. Now, what they remove in a soil test value, it's not a one-to-one. So if your soil test was sitting at, I'm going to use simple math. So if your soil test was sitting at 360 on K and your crop pulled off 60 pounds, that doesn't mean your soil test dropped to 300.
Correct.
Your soil test is probably still, I need to double check this, but it's probably still like 340, somewhere in that ballpark, which in that case for K means you've got adequate K out there.
Some of that will be recaptured by the fodder on the ground and so
forth. Some of that will be recaptured by the fodder on the ground, and it takes some rain to wash that back into the soil. And so if a farmer pulled those samples before we got some rains, those numbers might be actually lower than what they really are, because if the fodder stays, a lot of that P and K will wash back into the field, and we benefit from that year to year.
You know, I don't know that in, to be honest with you, in sitting where we're sitting right now, I don't know as we wouldn't be better off if we caught a little dry spell to go on and take a soil sample and then actually see where we are, you know, because we did have such a dry fall. And so if you did have those soil samples from last fall, they could be a little bit skewed. pH could be a little bit skewed from how dry it was. So this may be a year to, you know, if you can catch a little time here in January, just to jump out there and get them and go from there.
Speaking of how dry it was, and I don't know how many soil tests were even taken, for that matter, because like you alluded to, we talked about it yesterday, is just from the pure fact of being able to get to probe in the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the conditions just really are not there, weren't there to be able to take those samples in the fall. And that's a good idea to take advantage of those in the spring.
Catch a little dry spell, jump out there and get a few and see where you're at.
Well, soil tests are so, so valuable. They're not fun to take. Nobody enjoys – I don't know of anybody that necessarily just enjoys going out and pulling soil. Well, some of the soil scientists do, I guess. They're a little bit odd. But but having said that, it's such – I mean, even – and you're looking at – so even some places they pay for it. Some counties don't pay. Just kind of depends on how the counties are set up. But, you know, $5 for a soil sample that represents 5 acres. Let's just say it that way. Well, what if it turns out those 5 acres don't need potassium on them? That is a phenomenal savings if your plan was to apply 100 pounds of muriate.
Right.
Best $5 you could spend.
That is the cheapest way to spend some money to save a whole lot more later. One of the simplest things that can be done.
Yeah.
What about sidewall compaction? Usually I have several calls, you know, going out and doing field visits, farm visits, and sidewall compaction year in and year out. You know, that's an issue, and I know that you've talked about that a lot over the years, and I know we're starting to wind down here, but you know, I think that is worth saying something about and keeping sidewall compaction in your mind as we start planning for this 2023.
Being in the field one day too early as it's drying out gives us the sidewall compaction typically. And I get calls to bad fields on a regular basis, and a huge amount of those calls, there's some sidewall compaction at play. Now, sometimes there's some other things going on as well, but sidewall compaction is a phenomenal part of what we see. And it usually shows up as potassium deficiency. Sometimes it's a zinc deficiency or something else. And And so by the time I get out there, usually it's too late because it's later in the season. But yeah, that's a big one. That's a big one that we deal with every year.
And just keep that in mind as you're mm-hmm. as you're planning.
Yeah,
we need to make that our timely tip one of these days about one day how that could make a difference.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
We always try to have a timely tip and something that's really on everybody's mind right now this time of the year is to take advantage of educational opportunities to help improve your operation and get involved with commodity associations and different groups like that. We're right in the heart of our meeting season. We're all getting together right now on a pretty regular basis, and we encourage folks to take advantage of some of those opportunities that are close to you. Even some of the ones that are not that close to you, we all got too used to the Zoom thing, you know, during 2020, and almost all these opportunities have some type of Zoom link that you can tap into and join from a distance as well. So just want to encourage people to take part in those type of activities.
Yeah, especially getting involved with those commodity groups simply because you can stay up on what some of the current issues are. I mean, you know, how important is that, especially when we're talking about input prices and different things
Absolutely.
Like that, diesel fuel prices
sure.
and those kind of things. You know, we need to be up on what the trends are and what is affecting those products to make them that price.
I think that's a good point. So oftentimes producers are well aware of the obstacles that they have facing them from farm to farm to farm, but our commodity groups help to give us that world view of where our commodity stands and the obstacles that it faces worldwide. And those are not always brought to the forefront, but commodity groups do a good job of doing that.
And on a local level, I'm sorry, I didn't
well,
mean
Well, in our Kentucky organizations, they are recognized across the country for the amount of influence
yes.
and impact that they have.
Absolutely.
They're very well run. The farmers that are part of those are engaged. And they're always open and welcoming to more membership and more people being involved.
And that's a big part of it, staying engaged. It really
right.
is.
It is. It is.
And on a local level, too, I would encourage you, if you're not already, you know, reach out and to your extension office. In Kentucky, there's one in every county. Reach out to them. And if you've got ideas about something that you would like to learn more about, or you've got questions about, chances are you're not the only one that's wondering about that. And so reach out to us and let us know, because we can likely build a program around that. If you give us enough time, you know, we'll be able to put something together. So I'd encourage you to reach out to those if you're not already.
Absolutely. Well, folks, we appreciate it. Chad, we appreciate you being a part with us today, and want to thank our host for this week's information. Thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.